Kia ora and welcome to Goodfellow Podcasts. This episode is kindly supported by the Auckland Faculty of the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners. I'm Dr. Louise Kugler, and today I welcome Dr. Michael Drain to the podcast. So today we'll be discussing clearing your patient to fly safely. Michael practiced as a GP in the United Kingdom, the Wairarapa and Queensland. Currently, he is working as a medical officer for Air New Zealand as part of their medical team. Air New Zealand has a long-established aviation and occupational health unit, and his areas of interest include regulatory medicine and crew alertness management. Michael's held previous roles, which include work for the New Zealand Civil Aviation Authority, Emirates Airline, and the Australian Aviation Regulator, the Civil Aviation Safety Authority. Kia ora, Michael, and welcome to the podcast.
Morning.
So today we'll be discussing clearing your patient to fly safely, what you need to consider, and how to go about clearing your patient with medical conditions to fly safely. We're going to use a case to highlight some important points. So our patient is a 65-year-old with carcinoma of the bronchus, being transferred for palliative care from Auckland to Dunedin, with a background history of COPD and a chronic pneumothorax. Spinal secondaries are causing pain and sciatic irritation, with weakness affecting the right leg. So Michael, before we start discussing our three patient scenarios, I wonder if we can just start with setting the scene. New Zealand is a unique location, and we need to consider our position in the world as we make decisions for our patients. Can we talk about our location for a moment?
Yes, sure. Certainly, New Zealand is a long way from many of the places that we would serve. And New Zealand as an airline is, for its size, really quite a busy airline, and we operate extensively internationally. Even in 2021, with COVID still around, we operated over 160,000 flights. Approximately 18,000 of them were international. One of the challenges practically is that it's a long way to go anywhere. For example, flying from Auckland to Los Angeles is a roughly 12-hour flight. That's over 10,000 kilometers. Flying up to Japan, Narita, is almost 9,000 kilometers. Flying from Auckland to JFK Airport in New York is over 14,000 kilometers and takes 17 hours. So it's a long journey. And many of us are not actually accustomed to being in one place for that extended length of time. It does mean that there are some very particular things to think through when embarking on a trip of that nature.
So what are the common medical events that occur in flight?
Medical events are quite frequent. They can vary from being mild up to the life-threatening ones. The serious ones are relatively infrequent. Nevertheless, if you're a long way away from a source of help, clearly they propose an additional challenge. We need to be consistent in our approach and also bear in mind that flight attendants are not paramedics, they're not doctors, they have all had a first aid training. So the common things are common. So things like gastroenteritis, diarrhea and vomiting is one of the most common afflictions on board. The other thing which is listed as neurological problems often relates to faints and people just feeling generally unwell for one reason or another. Those are relatively mild and can be managed with simple supportive care.
And how often would a flight need to be diverted for a medical condition, deterioration or event?
Well, fortunately, diversions are very rare. In an average year, we might divert between 5 and 10 times, but that's always a last resort for a variety of reasons. The medical causes that lead to that will tend to be obviously much more serious matters, things such as severe chest pain, severe collapse, seizures, those sorts of serious events. But whether a diversion is the best way of handling an acute medical event is not always clear, particularly when you're a long way away from any decent hospital. You've got to be quite confident that a diversion is going to get you some adequate medical care. there are a lot of other factors as well, which are important. We need to remember that while we're concerned for the individual passenger who's unwell, there's the safety of all the other passengers on board, which is also paramount. And so flight safety considerations such as weather, familiar airports and other operational considerations are absolutely crucial. One of the benefits of carrying on to a known destination is the fact that you are well familiar with what services are available. So you can tee up things like ambulances, paramedic intervention, hospital admission ahead of time. If it's an unknown facility, you've got no capability on the ground to be able to organize that ahead of time. So while a diversion may sometimes seem like a good idea, in practice, it often raises some other problems which need to be considered.
Thinking about that, conducting a risk assessment for our patient who is wanting to fly, what sorts of things do we need to consider?
Well, I think the risk assessment needs to focus around the safety of a patient, a passenger. And as I mentioned, particularly for Air New Zealand international operations where you've got very long flights, it's important that the person is able to tolerate that length of time traveling. So it's both the transit through airports, which many of us will have experienced not always going according to plan, and also the in-flight environment. We need to bear in mind that just because a flight is nominally 10 hours, that disruptions happen. And, if there's a diversion or a delay, then that can throw all your preparations out of whack. And you're thinking about things like portable oxygen concentrators that have got a fixed battery life. What happens if you do get delayed and you need to have that support for an additional 12 hours? All these sorts of things do need to be considered. There's also the safety and the comfort of other passengers. And there are some conditions where clearly other passengers might be quite seriously impacted by that. And so there's always, as part of the risk and in the routine questioning, there's always a question about whether an individual's condition is likely to impact on other passengers. And sometimes we can use some discretion, perhaps in where we seat passengers or provision of a toilet nearby and those sorts of considerations to minimize the upset. There's also questions of public health. Is somebody presenting an infection risk to others? I mean, that's been very topical through COVID. It is a practical consideration. And clearly, if someone has got an active infection, then in general terms, they would not be able to fly on a commercial flight. And finally, I think the individual's mobility and considerations of toileting and feeding are also important. The more modern the aircraft, the better the facilities. So there are assisted toilets on Air New Zealand's wide-body aircraft, and it's usually possible to seat passengers where that's of assistance, close to the appropriate toileting facility.
Michael, I wonder if we could discuss altitude for a moment. What do we need to consider when factoring altitude into our decisions? Thinking perhaps the altitude effect, cabin altitude, and hypoxia risks.
Cabin altitudes have gradually reduced with the more modern aircraft. Aircraft may be flying higher than they used to, typically between 28,000 and 41,000 feet. But the more modern the aircraft, the lower the actual cabin altitude. But 787s, for example, which would be the aircraft which operate to Chicago and New York from Auckland, they will operate up to 41,000 feet, but maintain a cabin altitude of between 5,000 and 6,000 feet. So this means the actual exposure to reduced pressure and reduced oxygen is lower. And people sometimes find that that eases the sense of jet lag. The environment is constantly adjusted and controlled to maintain that pressure and that temperature. But the critical issue that one has to think about is what happens to any gas-filled spaces in our bodies as we climb. As the pressure reduces, the volume in our bodies of gas can expand up to about 30%. And so that matters for, typically for our ears, our sinuses, where we need to make sure that we can make them pop. Otherwise, it becomes extremely painful. The other problem that runs along parallel to that, of course, is with the reduced pressure, that the partial pressure of oxygen also reduces. And typically, cruise altitude is equivalent to roughly 15% oxygen on the ground. This is not a problem usually for healthy individuals. You may get a reduction in oxygen saturation and hemoglobin of 3 to 4%, and most people are not bothered by that. Clearly, it does become a problem in those people with already compromised cardiorespiratory function. We see a range of hypoxic risks. This can be due to pre-existing cardiac problems. It may be pulmonary problems and sometimes sort of hematological disease. If you've got a reduced baseline tissue oxygenation, then the stress of the additional hypoxia can become apparent. And there may well be an associated medical problem which reduces the ability of an individual to compensate. I mean, one needs to bear in mind that in some parts of the world, people are living at altitude already. So going in an aeroplane to 8,000 feet really is unlikely to present any issues. But for many Kiwis living at sea level, it's much more of an issue. So it does vary from person to person, and an individual consideration of the impact of the hypoxia is important. Specifically, we need to think of what are the medically induced risks. So are there trapped gases due to illness or treatment? Classically, you're concerned about things like a pneumomediastinum, pneumothorax, pneumocephalus, which may be induced after surgery. And in general terms, we would never accept somebody to fly on a commercial flight with pneumocephalus or a pneumothorax, which hasn't been appropriately managed. Bear in mind also that some ophthalmic surgery involves installation of gas into the eye. So there are those sorts of considerations that we do need to bear in mind when a passenger is going to be traveling by air. Air ambulances occasionally will need to maintain a cabin altitude that's equivalent to sea level, but that's a very specific operation and certainly not something that would be contemplated in a commercial environment.
Thank you, Michael. So now thinking about what airlines can actually assist our patients with and what's unrealistic to expect them to offer, tell us what to expect here.
Sure. And this is probably where it's really helpful from a GPing perspective to have a grasp of what is available and what isn't available. Depends a little bit which part of the world they're coming from, but sometimes passengers feel it's a bit of an intrusion to their privacy to have to talk about what their medical conditions are. When we know what the issues are, then we're in a much better position to provide some suitable assistance. So mobility assistance to the aircraft, for example, the use of wheelchairs. Most dietary requirements can be catered for. Passengers would sometimes request proximity to a disabled toilet. Indeed, having oxygen in flight is quite a frequent request, and many people these days will have their own portable oxygen concentrators, and so we frequently have passengers traveling with those on board. Airlines can also offer provision for stretchers and ventilation support for seriously ill passengers, but that's a significant operation and undertaking in terms of arranging the seating and arranging the aircraft appropriately so that there's power supply, oxygen supply as needed. So that requires some specialist support to do that. But nevertheless, we do that from time to time. And while Air New Zealand doesn't have this, some airlines specifically offer an intensive care rig to enable the transportation of seriously ill patients. I think it's fair to say what the airlines can't offer, because we get asked for all sorts of things. We had one passenger who said that they were requiring an allergen-free environment. Plainly, an aircraft like anywhere else in the world cannot offer an allergen-free environment. Particularly, this is with reference to peanut allergies very often. And while great effort is made to reduce the risk of exposure to peanuts, as we know, acute anaphylaxis can happen with tiny doses of an allergen. So it's simply impossible to guarantee that. And in fact, for patients who are severely allergic, then it is clearly important that they have got their management plan in cases of acute anaphylaxis, and carry an EpiPen or whatever is required. So other things that I think it's important just to be aware of, patient handling and nursing care is not available in flight. So flight attendants are not nurses. They have already got responsibilities for the safety of that flight. And it's quite important that any patient handling or nursing care is taken care of by a companion or appropriately qualified health practitioner accompanying that passenger on the flight. Extra leg room is sometimes requested, and that is certainly available, but passengers would be expected to purchase the appropriate seat to get that. The crew cannot provide assistance for feeding or toileting or medical escorts or indeed maternity services, all of which are sometimes requested. Similarly, an airline cannot provide a secure environment for psychotic passengers. I have to say that final consideration is something which is a real concern. And even doctors are not always aware of the potential risks of psychotic passengers traveling. There was one occasion where a passenger decided they wanted to exit the aircraft halfway across the TAS. And it's incredibly distressing for other passengers when that sort of thing happens. The flight was all managed safely, but it's nevertheless distressing. So flagging those sorts of concerns ahead of time is incredibly important to avoid unnecessary upset and make sure that the passenger involved and the patient involved has a safe trip.
Medical escorts, Michael, what are the requirements for the escort?
That's a very important question. There are many, many occasions where medical escorts are required. We frequently see people who have a terminal illness and they're keen to return to a family across the water, either to New Zealand or from New Zealand, and having an appropriate level of care for that journey so that it is something that is uneventful, something that is actively and proactively managed, is so important. So to do that, escorts need to have the appropriate skills to manage whatever the most likely clinical issues are. It's no good just having someone described as a nurse expected to come along and provide cardiopulmonary resuscitation and airway support by themselves, but without adequate training or equipment. We need the escort to be fully competent in doing whatever is the identified task. And they also need to have the appropriate equipment with them. The other thing that sometimes causes some upset is when a close relative of the traveling patient happens to be a health professional and says, "Don't worry, I can do this." Well, as we're aware, there are some clear ethical and professional obligations about treating loved ones. And certainly as far as air transport is concerned, the medical escort needs to be someone who is independent of the traveling family. But that's certainly something that we will assist in organizing, and that may involve us talking to rest homes, hospitals, hospice carers, specialists, just to make sure that what we're doing is appropriate and consistent with those identified health needs.
Thank you, Michael. That's given us a really good background. And with that information in mind, what is the process for requesting specific assistance and medical clearance for our patients?
I can well remember the first time I ever got presented with this MEDIF form, thinking, "Help, I have no idea. I've never seen one of these things before. What do I have to do?" So that's a good question. It's important to demystify this. So the International Air Transport Association, so it's an international organization of airlines, has got a standardized questionnaire which is specifically written to try and provide the sort of information that an operator, an airline, needs to know to make decisions about how to support that passenger in travel. So they're called MEDIFs, Medical Information Forms. They're available on most airlines' websites. There are three parts. One of it's filled in by the intended passenger or a relative, and that's essentially a consent to release medical information to the airline. The second part is to be filled by a medical practitioner who knows the passenger and has to make some pass some opinions about the person's ability to travel and what support needs they're going to have. It's particularly helpful to have the clinical information. Sometimes people are very limited in the sort of information that is provided about their medical condition, and that greatly delays the whole process. If we have to go back to them or then go to a hospital or specialist to try and find out what the real issues are, then that makes the whole thing a lot more cumbersome and slower to organize. It's designed to request assistance that's specific to this particular individual. There is a question that asks for an opinion about medical fitness. Please note that the question about medical fitness is not a general prognosis, and that's sometimes confusing. So if you've got somebody who's terminally ill, this is not really requesting an opinion about their particular terminal illness. It's that the opinion on medical fitness is specifically related to travel. If there are some difficulties that the travel is likely to present, then that's really important so that we know that that's somebody who's going to need additional attention to make sure that this is going to be a comfortable journey for them. And I think the other thing, which is often a fear to passengers who are unwell, I think it's important to emphasize that actually very, very few passengers are ever denied travel. Most people that do end up being denied travel can usually travel once whatever the condition they have is stabilized. As I mentioned, we have an issue that there are not many hospitals, sizable hospitals, halfway across the Pacific. So stability is a particular issue that we're interested in. And the other thing to think about, of course, is that managing medical problems in advance can often prevent deterioration in flight. So a bit of pre-flight preparation and a conversation with the GP is very valuable. If people are wondering how we're likely to address different medical issues, I've mentioned parts one and two of the MEDIF. There's a part three, which is called the Guidelines for Doctors. All of these are on the Air New Zealand website and are available for reference. And if you're not sure, then I would strongly encourage you to ask. I think I still remember the shock of my first ever seeing a MEDIF, but Air New Zealand has got a medical department and an excellent passenger care team. So if you have questions, please don't feel embarrassed about picking up the phone and talking to us or simply emailing. Most airlines will have their passenger care teams and provide contacts for conversations with medical professionals to know what to do. And in addition, there's also some resources which give some guidance about air travel too.
So thinking about more information on the process, you've mentioned the Air New Zealand website. Is there anywhere else that we should be looking?
Yeah, sure. So most airline medical departments do have guidance on their websites. It does vary a little bit from airline to airline, but in general, it's all there. There's quite a useful, if you want a useful resource, the Aerospace Medicine Society, ASMA, have got a document called Medical Guidelines for Air Travel. That provides quite a good overview and goes into a little bit more detail about things such as pulmonary function, cardiorespiratory issues in flight. And so that is actually quite a good resource.
Michael, as a primary care provider, if we've got enough information, are we able to clear a patient ourselves or do we need specialist or aviation medicine support?
The vast majority of medical information forms would be completed by general practitioners, and most GPs are in a position to be able to provide the background information. In law, clearance to travel actually is the responsibility of the captain flying that particular flight. That's where the final decision lies. So any decision that is made by the airline medical department is made on behalf of the captain, but the captain still retains actually a veto. That's very much the same principle as used to happen in the maritime world. And where we have particularly unwell patients, we do actually brief the captain and the flight attendant so that they're aware of any particular needs on board that flight. But in practical terms, the GP is well positioned to fill in that medical information form. Whether or not somebody can be transported is ultimately the decision of the airline. And as I said, ultimately the captain who flies that particular flight. That very few people would be denied travel. It's probably an appropriate moment just to mention that one of the, I think, most frustrating situations, both for the intending passenger and also for the airline, is when people do not say anything early on and present at the gate with evident medical problems. Then we do see people denied travel, and that's very distressing for the individuals and hugely disruptive for everybody. So the MEDA is a really good process to make sure that that doesn't happen, that people intend to travel can have a comfortable flight.
That's a great point. Thank you. So, Michael, I wonder if we can loop back to our 65-year-old that had carcinoma of the bronchus, who was being transferred from Auckland to Dunedin. COPD with a chronic pneumothorax and spinal secondaries causing pain and sciatic irritation with weakness affecting the right leg. What do we need to consider when clearing this patient to fly?
So in the first case, we've got a few issues here. Somebody with a carcinoma of the bronchus who's already requiring palliative care. They've got a chronic pneumothorax and a history of COPD. It's a disseminated disease, so it's caused significant impairments and debility and symptoms. So there's a whole range of problems. And as I mentioned early on, actually, we do find we have quite a lot of requests for transportation of people who are quite seriously unwell. So the first point here is to start organizing the MEDA early. Don't leave it to the last minute. Secondly, I would, for somebody with a multi-system disease such as this, I would consider asking the treating specialist to provide a specific report. While the general practitioner is probably very good at being able to pull together the different people who have been providing input into this individual's care, sometimes, and we're looking at somebody here with a significant respiratory problem, sometimes we do need a specialist input to give us the relevant information to know how someone's going to cope in a low-pressure, low-oxygen environment. So mentioning that, we would have a concern about that. We've got somebody who we know has got a chronic pulmonary condition, and the question arises, how would they cope on the equivalent of 15% inspired oxygen? And the answer there is, well, we don't know unless we investigate a little bit further. There are some tests, one of them particularly that is done is the HAST test, which is an altitude simulation test where people are given 15% oxygen to breathe and their oxygen saturation is then monitored. In cases of severe COPD, you'll see a progressive decrease in oxygen saturation and an unacceptable long-term decrease in oxygen saturation. And it also provides the opportunity to determine what's the appropriate prescription for oxygen to cope in that hypoxic environment. So it's not just the fact that they need oxygen. The airline needs to know how much, what dosage, and particularly for people who have got respiratory failure, it's critical that the correct prescription is given. The airline is quite able to organize oxygen, but it's not able to guess what's needed. That has to be something that is clearly determined by the relevant doctor. The other question in this situation is, well, how does someone with a chronic pneumothorax cope in flight? So we've got both the hypoxic issue, but we've also got the hypobaric issue as well. And typically a pneumothorax is going to increase in size. And typically that could be an increase in size of say 30%. For a large pneumothorax, that can clearly cause some significant respiratory embarrassment. So that is something that would need to be discussed with the treating specialist. Generally, we do not carry people with pneumothoraces unless they have got an underwater drain in place. But that is usually something which is evaluated on a case-by-case basis. With small pneumothoraces, probably the enlargement would be insufficient to cause any additional symptoms, but that's not something that one would make any generalization about. The other issue is that you've got somebody who has got severe and chronic pain and neurological weakness. So thought needs to be given to how to make sure that the passenger is going to be comfortable for the duration of the flight. And while a short hop, if someone is merely being flown for 45 minutes, might mean that your pain relief doesn't need to be altered or adjusted enormously. You certainly need to give thought to somebody who's going to be on an aircraft for a long period of time and possibly sitting in a seat for a long period of time and how they would cope with that. What sort of pain relief strategies, what sort of pain management strategies are in place to help an individual have a comfortable flight? And the practical question about somebody who's already got some debility, will they be able to cope with an ordinary seat? Do they need to be able to have a lie flat seat in business? Do they need to be able to access the toilet or have assistance to the toilet? There's a whole range of practical questions which will be worked through. And as I said earlier, the passenger care teams are very practiced and skilled at making arrangements for passengers as they need it. So the answer to the question, can this person be carried? There are very few people who we would ever decline from carrying, but this is clearly somebody where having a report from a respiratory physician and probably the palliative care doctor providing some information about the best supportive care for the journey would be immensely helpful in ensuring that they have a comfortable journey.
Fantastic, Michael. And to conclude our podcast today, please, your take-home messages for our listeners.
Yes, I think the takeaways from this are plan ahead. MEDAs exist for the safety of the flight and for the benefit of passengers. And I mentioned earlier, some passengers are a bit suspicious about why the airline wants to know about their medical conditions. And it's really trying to organize travel with the minimum of stress. The worst thing that can happen, in my mind, is arriving at the gate, not feeling that brilliant, and then being refused boarding. That's just a disaster for everybody. So planning ahead is important. Plan early. Don't leave it to the last minute. There are a variety of issues to think about. Is a report from the treating doctor needed? They sometimes take a while. There are rules about equipment and batteries that may need clearance. Plan for the unexpected. Weather happens, delays happen, diversions happen. Sometimes these can take a long time. In terms of medical conditions, I think behavioral problems are tricky. We had one slightly difficult situation to manage when we had a person with Tourette's who said, I've got COVID quite loudly. We managed to transport them, but it required a little bit of care in arranging seating and boarding. So behavioral problems can be tricky. Flight attendants are not nursing staff, so appropriate care must be provided when necessary. And finally, please talk to us. The passenger care team are available and we'd be happy to hear from you. Please don't hesitate to ask.
Thank you, Michael. If you're a New Zealand GP and would like to claim CPD points for listening to our podcasts are eligible, so please log them. You'll also find a list of resources that we've used in making this podcast at goodfellowunit.org. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Michael.